Welcome to another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast for athletes, Olympians and sports people, reflecting on the challenges of elite sport, both whilst participating and navigating the path beyond. And in this episode, we're going to get a coaching perspective on athlete care, mental health and indeed get our three guests to reflect on their own transition pathways into their current roles. I'm Mark Clement. Alongside me is Scott Ward, a retired professional footballer who spent more than a decade working on the content that now makes up EY's personal performance program, Building a Better Working World, and indeed this podcast. And joining us for this episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, renowned equestrian coach and rider Victoria Gallantry, England lead performance boxing coach Mick Driscoll. Mick's recently been nominated for a European Boxing Confederation Award and coach developer for UK coaching, and former international basketball coach and indeed player Jenny Cody. And this is a really important podcast, Scott, because these roles are, or this role is pivotal to changes in attitude, to provision of good athlete care and just general welfare across the board in sport.
Yeah, I think we've got a few pockets of discussion for today, Mark. I think it's not only looking at how we can increase the care for athletes, but it's also ensuring that the coaches themselves are being catered for. You know, over the last few weeks, there's been a heightened awareness around mental health for coaches, which is great that we're talking about it, but it's actually installing something that is practical and can be implemented without expectation of governing bodies or everyone else in those circles changing towards medal counts or what that element of success is for the athletes themselves. They are the point of inspiration, and unless they're able to compute and work functionally every day, we can't expect them to inspire those of tomorrow.
Do you mention that because of the current, well, let's call it an epidemic of mental health issues in society? Do you mention that because there are certain drivers in sport that might lead people towards mental health stress?
Well, I just think that from a coaching dynamic, the pressures of performance are that much higher now. Expectations increased over the last decade or so, and therefore the resilience of the coach is having to increase just by that gift of expectation. So especially now with the athlete coach, where people are becoming coaches after retiring from being a performing athlete, are we giving them the tools to thrive? Because clearly that's a very different mentality and a coping mechanism that's required from being a selfish individual potentially and worrying about your own performance to perhaps worrying about the livelihoods of 50 other people that you're having to cater for on a daily basis.
And Jenny, I gave you lots of titles there, but putting on your coach developer hat, are you dealing with a lot of former athletes that are still finding their way out of participating in sport? So maybe they are challenged in that transition and their mindset is partly on, I haven't quite processed the fact I'm no longer doing it myself.
Yeah, it's really good angle. I think what I'm seeing as I go through the different cohorts of coaches is they were athletes before they came onto the program, and they went through that kind of linear curriculum, coach education path, or they've just come. So they've just, so a couple of coaches who are on the program are currently athletes at a, you know, World Cup level in August, and then coming into coaching camps with athletes that are trying to take what lens they're in and what's just happened and try to package it in for the best experience. So we kind of strip that back and say, well, what lens, what journey have you been on? And then as you do, it's kind of, Scott's made a really, really good kind of key points there. They have a position where they've had to stop and wave a white flag and say, actually, I need a bit of help on this, but I don't really know how or who to ask for it. I know the opportunities are there maybe to be signposted, but if I stop, is someone else going to take my role? Is this opportunity as a coach going through the pathway going to be given to somebody else?
So that anxiety is hanging over a coach as well. It's performance driven. It's if you take a breather, you might miss out on the opportunity, or your own evolution might not be as fast as it might have been.
That's exactly it. And there are those external pressures of podium medal funding. I would often start with a question, even if I'm having a chat with a coach, about what gets you out of bed in the morning? And, you know, is it the coaching? Is it the raw you and the athletes and the person in front of you, where now it's the extra hats? You have to identify this, that and the other. You have to be all these different people and different services to the people in front of you. And sometimes that gets lost in translation.
Mick Driscoll, what gets you out of bed in the morning?
boxing, love boxing. So, yeah, it's good for me.
Well, I mean, and into coaching. I mean, obviously, you spent years in the ring yourself, but how did your own coaching pathway come about?
I packed in when I was about 25, and I had 2 or 3 years out of it. And I completely went away completely. Barry Earn gave me some fantastic advice, and he said, "Look, if you're serious about packing in boxing, walk away totally." He said, "Because what will happen is in 6 months' time, you have a bit of a beer belly and something." He said, "Oh, I'll get back in the gym. You won't go to a normal gym, you go to a boxing gym, because that's what you do. Within 6 months, you'll be boxing again. You'll be sparring again, be boxing again, and you'll get back on the gravy train. And if you're going to finish like where you are, you're best staying where you are." So I'd completely isolated from boxing for about 3-4 years, totally didn't see it on the telly, didn't watch anything at all, didn't magazine, didn't books, in a paper. I just went straight past things onto football and other stuff, so completely out of it. My boy was about 6, I'd always done little bits with him in the house and stuff, but never actually, like I said, I never watched it on the telly or got involved in it or anything. Said he wanted to box, made some contacts, went down to West Ham Boxing Club. The rest is history. I went through the door and said I wasn't going to do anything, I was just going to sit there and be a dad. You know, 6 weeks later, asking me to do pads, asking my opinion on this, asking my opinion on that. I'm very fortunate that I had a guy called Mickey May, don't know if you know him, renowned boxing coach, Mickey May, who took on me like a son and like a mentor. And the rest is history. And I think what's good for me is sometimes what's hard when you go from being an athlete, I think, to being a coach, sometimes you get fast-tracked too quickly and you don't do the grassroots stuff. So you're not going to the horrible little venues in Weymouth on a Thursday night or Bristol on a Thursday night and getting stitched up with decisions and so forth and seeing the actual makings of the sport, you know, and all them skills you can later lose later in life, you know, at the highest level.
Well, we'll develop that, but I've got to bring you back. What was it that led you to want to quit boxing yourself at 25? And why was it that you wanted to completely wash your hands of it?
I've got to be careful what I say, but pro boxing is completely different than amateur boxing. So in amateur boxing, you've got somebody that's like a mentor to you, a coach. It's life skills, you know. They're telling you what they want to tell you.
This is amateur boxing?
Amateur boxing. Okay. They're telling you, so you're going in that gym 7 nights a week, 5 nights a week. They're coaching you because they want to coach you. They're telling you what they want to tell you. Not for a pound note, for anything. 99% of amateur boxing is volunteers. I'm fortunate. I get paid, obviously, as an England coach. But 99% of coaches in the sport are volunteers and do some amazing jobs for kids that not successful or are successful. They're successful in life. You then go to the professional side. It's about the dollar. It's a business, you know. And for me, it was just the lies, the build up to it, and you're going to get this, you're going to get that, you're not going to get this. If you beat this person, you do this. It's just all the rubbish that goes with it that I just had enough of, that sort of takes that hunger away from you, that I've got back again now through coaching. I'm very fortunate.
I think that's a really fascinating comment for me. So I'm a recent boxing fan. You know, me and my 3 other brothers in London, boxing was always a big part. It was a big part for my dad and my granddad living up in the East End. But you look at recent boxers, and I would say their reliance on their corner at times in pro matches is so heavy that during a round, for example, you can see there's no independent thought. So if their counterpart tries to do something different in a round, so if he goes to a southpaw, for example, they don't know how to react. And I think what you're saying there is, when you're in an amateur, you know that you're being exposed to everything you need to be exposed to for the betterment of yourself, because that's what you're trying to achieve as a coach, right? You're trying to make sure that this kid in front of you can survive in the ring, more importantly, and out of it. And I think there have been comments recently about some of the more high profile fights where, you know, the boxers just haven't known what key to turn in those certain situations. And like you say, is that because things are being molded for the betterment of the brand, of the pound note that's being turned? It's a real topical discussion, I think, at the minute. And I heard Deontay Wilder, for example, in the last fortnight start talking about his personal development against others in that same level. And, you know, are decisions being made because they're the right decisions for that person, or are they being made because they're the right decisions for that company?
Pro boxing's full of politics. Going back to what you were saying about making the decision, life skills have taught me from being a boxer, from boxing for England as a kid, and having that sort of mindset. Boxing's sort of stuck in the 1950s, where even you're looking at preparation camps at international level, people are looking at doing all endurance work for 4 weeks, and then 2 weeks of doing sprints and stuff, and weight making and training in sweatsuits. That's gone out with the dark ages. Things have changed. we've brought in a big thing. About 3 years ago, I did a summer tour. I went to 10 locations all around the country trying to change the mindset of England boxing, because without getting too deep, because I'll be here for hours talking about it, but I'll go to every gym in the country. I've got every gym I can go to. I was at West Ham 15 years, and the national coach didn't come to the gym once. And it was the most successful club in the country. That's in Repton, just around the corner from us, and probably knew him. So I make a point of going to all different clubs. And too often in boxing, what I feel, just my opinion, you go into the gym, most gyms, they do shadow boxing at the beginning. It's used as a conditioning tool. And what it should be used for is a visual tool. You look at most world champion pros, you can visualise as what he's looking for is boxing inside, he's outside, he's at range. Most kids don't do that in gyms nowadays. It's used as a conditioning tool. The only actual learning tool in gyms is when they spar, open sparring. And without being visual, it's a lot easier for me to practice blocking that when something's not coming at me than actually getting it and going, you've got to block it next time. Yeah, thanks for telling me. You know, little things like that. So the problem we've got is lots of things in gyms, it's the culture where it's so coach-led. Going back to what you said, there's a bit of politics what we're going from in a minute with possibly AJ and stuff like that, what you're saying. But with the amateurs, it's so coach-led that we was talking earlier, the coach is God in his gym, does what he wants to do. He'll go to a workshop to learn something different. Within 2 weeks, he's forgot that he's doing what he's always done. So when I've come onto England, like I said, 3 years ago, I did a summer tour about AIR, adaptable, independent, resilient and robust. And it's something we live off now as England boxing. So we try to, every single program we put in place for a tournament, for a Europeans, for a Worlds, for Olympics, we bring in AIR. So we have to have it adaptable. What's adaptable? Why are we having plans? So we're telling kids what we're going to be doing all weekend. This afternoon, we're going to do a good run this morning. Then this afternoon, you're sparring AJ. Do you truthfully think you're going to give it 1,000% on that run? You're not. Because in the back of your head, you're going to be thinking, hold on, I'm not sparring AJ this afternoon. I'm going to hold back a little bit. So we don't tell them what they're doing. Loads of little bits, little games. I'll be here too long talking to you about it. But the big thing we've got about is this AIR. Adaptable, independent, resilient, robust. You then flip it on the coin side to the coach. What you just said there, we make a point to the kids from 12 years old. You're in a contest. We get tactics. You're boxing a southpaw, very strong, blah, blah, blah. Get the right tactics. That kid goes out and the kid's completely opposite. At what stage do you change tactics? What stage? Do you wait to the corner? Do you come back to the corner to tell you? Do you wait to the end of the fight? Or do you act straight away?
Yeah.
Victoria Gallantry, you're nodding away there. I mean, yeah. Mick's talking in a lot of technical detail, but is he also talking in a coach's language as well that you can relate to?
Oh, yeah, I can really relate to. I mean, that adaptability, resilience, independence. And I really liked and could resonate what he said about, as a young coach, you've got to do your time at the lowest, at not the lowest, but the participant level. And I mean it, not the lowest, because it's, to me, it's the foundations for every sport. And if you don't look after them, and in the horse world, and I don't know if in the other sports, but not always the most technical, experienced coaches are coaching at that level. So they're not getting exposed to the best training and coaching and experience and environment that they need.
What people are being fast-tracked, maybe named.
Or the other way. Sometimes they're choosing not to coach at that level because they feel like it's under them.
Because they're high-performance athletes, they're thinking, I want to go in at a high-performance coach level.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you're having to recognise that you're going into a different career, and that career path is starting at the foundation level, let's call it. So, and I think that's a really great thing for participant athletes and people who are coming into a sport to get a flavour of what it's like to be coached by a top athlete themselves. And that can be quite inspirational and help people get going.
I think that's a good point there. I may have the coach developer hat on. But whatever the level is, I think the support angle is really important. You're looking at, like, if it is participation level, and it's a parent of a child who's on the sideline, all of a sudden gets roped in to do something. It's like, okay, now will you take this under 10s or under 12 group? And all of a sudden they're left on their own in a gym and to feel their way through maybe YouTube or an odd level one that they do, or level two to progress through. And the similar I have seen, and we've spoke about in our group with the different coaches, that if they do transition from an athlete or fast tracked, or, you know, jump into a high performance environment, the same is, you've just come off a World Cup, you've come off a European, surely you can have a chat and, oh, you'd like to take this group or go for individuals. And that's shaping with their lens what happens in that journey. And on the back of the coach led, and we're hearing a lot about different approaches and different angles, and sometimes different conversations I'm having and listening to different podcasts, that athlete-led approach is taken from one spectrum to another. It's like, oh, I should take this on. Yeah. Coaches of all level. I think I'll go with the athlete head approach, and I'm going, right, okay, well, now I'm going to let you coach yourself. There you go. We're all in the gym and you do the warm up. And given the athlete that much rope sometimes can affect their self-esteem, their confidence, because then they don't know, they're not getting that feedback and they're not ready for the feedback. So it's just interesting to see what different support systems are in place to have that open, honest feedback that happens.
Well, I'm confused because on the one hand, we're complaining about the godlike status of some coaches running their own gyms like fiefdoms. On the other hand, you're talking about withholding information about what's coming next. So isn't there an aspect of dictatorialness? Is that a word? Is that a phrase?
I
think you need a novice style. Yeah. I think the novice style. I think to start in grassroots, you can't just bring somebody straight in the box and go, do what you want to do, because then they're going to have to a benchmark where you're going. So at England level, we're probably more at a stage where they're going to be national champions or something, where we can say, hold your hands up, do this, they know what they're doing. You can have a little bit of giving them a little bit of ownership when they start thinking for themselves, because lots of athletes don't actually think for themselves.
Can I jump in and just say that I think in the equestrian world, we're really lucky that we've got the British Shore Society on one side and the Pony Club on the other, where these athletes are really young and there is a system that's been established over 70, 80 years. And it's been brought on the back of a military background. So, although it was quite coach-led to start with, it has progressed to becoming quite athlete-led and children-led, but it's got those rules and everything. So you've got athletes who are just riding horses and that's what they're doing. Then you've actually got coaches being taught from 16 and they can just go down the coaching route. So by the time they're 26, they've had their 10 years experience. And I don't know if that's in every sport, but then you've got the horse as well teaching you so much. I mean, we've got our athletes four-legged as well as two-legged, so.
I think it's a side point on it, but I think it's really interesting that we're talking about going back to grassroots, and I do support the angle, but I think it's a lot about self-awareness. And, if you come from, on this particular topic, from an athlete into a coach, looking at different levels of emotional intelligence and self-awareness and the journey they've been on, and then they go into coaching. If it is a high performance level that they go in at, it's their journey on how self-aware I am and where I am in this process. So I don't necessarily always think it needs to be back to grassroots, but an awareness of what that environment looks like you are visiting all the gyms in the country. There's an awareness around you. There's no ego attached to it. I'm going in with open mind. Mm-hmm. I have some skill. I have a lot of respect behind me, but I'm not going in with that hat. I'm not going in with my badge today. I want to chat to this lad in the corner, that athlete, see what's going on, share my information, and then bring that forward. And it's how you connect the dots, I think, when you
I think so. What I was going to say a moment ago is that I think this is all about honesty. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter whether you're 22, 32, 42, because I think as well around coaching there is an issue around ageism. I think that if you're 22, the perception is you don't have the experience. But as you've just said, if you may have been in the system for 6 or 7 years already, so you may have learnt an awful lot in that time, and you may have been an athlete before that. I think as long as there's an honesty around what we're trying to achieve and why we're trying to achieve it, people can then aspire to be better, knowing what that landscape needs to look like for progression.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty is that at times we try and create that element of smoke and mirrors, because apparently there's a magic potion to become good, and there's not. You just got to graft. If you graft and you put the work in, you do your hours, you listen to people and you appreciate the role of others, you will get better. But sometimes we look for that quick answer and, okay, I can go from 0 to 100 overnight. And that's just not realistic.
Would you say that it's really useful at that point as well, that honesty that you've got, but also to have an honest feedback from a mentor? You mentioned a coach.
Yeah.
Somebody else that you can trust, value, respect.
This is it. That brings a maturity, doesn't it?
And if you've got that with you, and then you can say, how did that session go? And have that shadowing, somebody who's watching you, giving you that honest feedback so you can progress. Because quite often you think, oh, I've been doing it for 10 years, I'm really good now. Well, actually, somebody's been doing 3 years and actually studying and working and doing the feedback can be of quite a high quality as well. So
length of time. A lot of imponderables here as well. Doesn't fit come into this? Finding the mentor that works for you in the same way as Mick might look for a certain type of boxer that kind of is in synergy with him, or you've, as you say, you've got two elements to try to fit together there.
You said about your mentor. If you describe your mentor a bit, I might describe mine. I would think those qualities are probably similar. What do you like?
Sometimes a mentor isn't everything you want to be. It's something that you think, I wouldn't do that. I mean, there's lots of good things I've got from Mick. I'm not going to lie to you. You know, very motivational bits and pieces, but at the same time, there's things that I think, and I look back and I think, I wouldn't do that if that was me. And I'll get an opportunity and I think, I'll see anything that reacts to the boxers. I think the big thing I think that I've got with boxing is that it's about the boxer. The first rule of coaching or refereeing or judging or anything, it's about the boxer's welfare. Too many coaches forget that. And we said before about egos and stuff like that. That's the biggest problem we've got. That's what we're trying to bring in with this air. It's about the boxer. Some boxers like to say, do you know what? Can I do this? Can I do that? Do whatever you want to do. If you want to do that, if you win the fight, that's what matters, isn't it? It's about winning. Whatever you're doing, whether you're riding, playing football, whatever you do, it's do what you enjoy. If you enjoy it, you'll do well.
But and would you say you're thinking about the boxer, but you could also say you're thinking about the person as well as the boxer, even that, you know, the whole person.
The person. The person's a massive thing, because you can be the best coach in the world, be a right plonker. You know what I'm saying? As a person, not gone with a team. It's about being part of a team as well as being part of lots of things, isn't it? So I think personal skills are massive, isn't it? It's the biggest thing.
Honesty comes in. Yeah, of course. It's honesty about what you're saying to somebody. It's about your actions. It's about what your motivation is. It's about why you're driving that person. Is it because I want to step up in the ranks as a coach, or is it actually I want to make that kid better?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's where it's as simple as you could ever be in sport. You say, okay, what do you want? I want honesty. And people say it, but they don't really know what it means at times. And again, it's not just what you say to people, it's what you give them to. And that's like you said about a mentor, the mentor fit mark. You know, again, you have to be mature in that environment. If you're mentoring someone, you know, it's not working for them. You have to tell them. Mm. And the same for you. Look, I think I've reached my ceiling point for you now. You need to go to see someone else. That's a huge step, because that may have financial implications on you as well. But it's for the betterment of that person, not for you. And again, that goes back to motivation and honesty.
You could bounce off that about that honesty, but without breaking the relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, there's a real fine line as a coach, isn't there? Yeah. How honest you actually could be with that one person, but maybe you couldn't be because they're not ready for that full amount. And that's that art of coaching, isn't it?
I think a lot of people say they want honesty, but actually in reality, you have to be very careful. I do bits of coaching with presentation skills and communication, and there's no way you could critique people like you used to. So you must be having to teach the next generation of coaches in a whole different way, because that integration, you talked about emotional intelligence, you know.
Teach is an interesting word.
Teach, yeah, okay.
Yeah, like share. Share the journey. I think for my role, it's key to know what journey they've been on and what it's looked like.
Are you saying teach is a bad word in your...
No, just it means different things.
Okay.
I think as you come in, like feedback means different things. We do. So mentor, coach developing, those titles have been bounced around. And at the end of the day, it has to be somebody like I work with 13 different sports just in the southern area. And I'm experiencing them for the first time between ice skating, shooting. My own sport is basketball. So I have definitely a team lens. The last cohort and this cohort, I've only got one team sport. So it's me taking a step away from that to say, okay, well, actually, what does this sport look like? They're aware of what the program looks like before they come onto it. So they know that I don't have that tech angle. And that's not what I'm there. I'm not there to tell them how to hold this and what angle to shoot, any of those technical terms. So there's a bit of honesty on my part on what I can provide, what we can share together. And then if I don't know, it's a hand up, I don't know, I'll signpost you. Whereas I think other people maybe in that role feel that pressure of, I'm in a mentor role, I'm in a coach of a role, I should have all the answers. And yeah, I totally agree, Scott, that there's the coach and the person and the responsibilities, but actually it's the coach developer to remove the airs and graces, whatever your accolades are, be it, you know, medals and worlds or a different, you know, business journey, whatever road you've been on, it's that chat you have, it's the first chat you have with a coach, you know, be it back to the what gets you out of the bed in the morning. It may be the same, it may be different.
But that adaptability from a social skills point of view is so important as well, isn't it? Because there must be occasions where you can make or break somebody's day, a session, their week, a month, with a phrase, a sentence.
I like what you said earlier when you first done the introduction bit and you were talking about the pressure of being a coach. A lot of people don't realise it, especially in boxing. They just think, oh, it's national coach, it's got to be easy. You can be technical, the best in the world, the best S&C coach, the best whatever you want to be. But them life skills that says, hold on a minute, we've just lost 5 boxers, we need to get 7 medals or our jobs are on the line and we're not going to get the medals. People don't realise the pressure that comes into that, and actually the life skills and experience of saying, hold on a minute, everything's all right, no panic to the boxer, you're not putting no pressure onto the boxer or to Tottenham's got to win the league of the last game and they're stressing out, the manager's stressing out his nut. It's nothing like that. That's key things that a lot of people don't realise as part of being a coach as well. It's not just about how to throw a good left hook or how to get somebody fit. It's them life skills, like you've said, to get the best out of the athlete.
And that goes back to what we said earlier, isn't it? This is about the coach and as a person, not as a coach. Are they prepared? Are they okay? Are they going to thrive in that environment? Are we giving them enough to thrive with the heap of expectation that's being given to them as a present? You know, it's not even spoken of, it's expectation.
Yeah, I think when you were both talking there, I thought about those leadership skills and the emotional intelligence. And actually, if you're a leader and you can sort of lead one sort of area, the transfer skills are really easy. You can adapt and make it work for yourself. So Mick was saying about when he finished his sport and was going to go into coaching and just sort of walk away for a bit. Well, I sort of did a similar thing. So competing a lot, internationals, so I actually had a bad accident and my horse went at the same time. And you think, oh, you know, I'm going to just give it a break for a bit. Bought a young horse, so it's coming on now. But anyway, I decided to go down a sort of a new journey and look at the athlete on top, the rider, the person who was riding the horse, because quite often we make sure the horse can jump the jump. I'm being really basic now, but it's got to do its dressage, go show jumping, go cross country, go this. The horse has got
you
to
be
do
as basic as you like.
So some coaches will just say, this is what the horse has got to do. And then some coaches will work on the rider and get the rider to be able to teach a different horse to do different things. So I took an element of really looking at people skills and went down a counselling route just off my own back, and I just went down to the local college and did a level 1, and then I found out it was a level 2, and then I did a level 3, and it's just went into the horsey thing of like, oh well, there's a 1-star international, 2-star, 3-star, 4-star. So by the time I ended up having my own private practice in counselling, I'm thinking I only wanted to just go on a listening course. But it's that athlete mentality. Oh, there's another level. Got to do the next level. We've got to get to the top of.
But would you be the exception as a coach, wouldn't you, in going into that level of detail and appreciating?
You know, you said about a coach saying a certain thing.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me, and actually I brought it down to the Coaching UK, Isla Rorty, and she said, if you're going to take that top exam, the fellowship of the British Horse Society, you've got to be unique. You've got to bring something special to the table. So I thought, oh, I'll bring a counselling certificate with me. Little did I know that it was it's a huge subject. I've been doing it for 7 years on my own. So a bit like going into the ring, I don't know much about boxing, but I imagine any athletes out there on their own, kicking that ball against the wall, hitting that tennis racket again on their own for years and years and years, and then they perfect a skill and then somebody else notices them. Well, I've been doing this counselling on my own, come to Ernst & Young and got noticed, got somebody spoke to me and went, oh, you're interesting, I like what you're doing with the person.
Yeah, you are interesting. You'll have to explain what Isla Rorty is, please, because
Isla Rorty is a lady who writes books, and she's a coach,
she's
and
fantastic.
She's a mentor. And
what's
you know
she from?
She's equestrian.
Okay, horses.
Horses. Yeah, I only speak horse, really.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, you're doing pretty well on the boxing chat.
Oh, no, this is because I've known Mick for
years. From the programme.
professionally.
Jenny, if we talk about holistic care for coaches, there's going to be a big difference between somebody that's working maybe in a team environment, and somebody that's maybe coaching one-to-one, isn't there? Won't the tutelage, let me use that word, that you give those that are coaching one-to-one have to be different to those that Coaching teams.
It's interesting. I would say the program, the Performance Foundation program that we have, UK Coaching, has objectives. And although it's not a prescribed program, as you get into the detail, you see the relationship that Victoria and Mick have. It's about that bespoke nature of what it's
about. They are now holding hands. Just
oh, that's my personal responsibility. Well done. No, it's a bespoke program to see if we get in a room together, what that dynamic looks like, what the needs are of the group, what the needs of the individual are, and how organically we can develop that without being prescribed on, we're going to use this model, this tool, this digital platform, and it's what works best. And what other, again, go back to the journey, what angle are they coming from? What does success look like for them? So if success is to stay in the sport, if success is to handle critical instances in their sport, then it's my privilege, without being too soft, and it's my privilege to be part of their journey, and that's how I see the coach developing role for me.
Scott, how do we instill a winning culture without it being win at all costs?
I think unfortunately in sport it does take a bit of a horror story to create that point of realization around that there's more than the medals. And obviously more recently there have been some sad occurrences where that's been the case. You only have to look at the child welfare stories in football, for example, more recently that have typified that. I think, again, it goes back to dialogue. I think it does take a bravery to change the way that we speak and the narrative that we share in sport. But it's one of the drivers within EY. You know, it's been mentioned earlier about the single athletes trying to become elite and all the rest of it. And I was obviously part of a unique family of four brothers. But if you're trying to make that individual better, I think we have to make sure that they get the same support network that others do. And it's the same for coaches. If we're asking them to commit to sport, we have to make sure that they're getting the foundations of development for themselves based upon what they want to do. Whether it be stay amateur, become pro, just do grassroots coaching, because they still have to deal with the same consequences potentially. So if you've been in elite sport, for example, for 5 years, or you've competed in grassroots level sport for 10 years, if you don't get to that point of your aspiration, the ripple effect is just the same. So therefore, we need to make sure that mental health awareness is the same from the bottom up. We need to make sure that we are trying to give the best facilities possible to the individuals, whether it's Sunday league football or not, so that at least then they can enjoy it and participation is being increased, which then will contribute towards creating more athletes potentially. And it's the same with the coaches. If they're being asked to take on more kids to coach, are we giving them the time to be able to do that consciously, or are we making them time poor, which is going to incorporate bad decisions? And then again, we will have to live with those long-term consequences. So I know there's a lot that I've spoken around there, and it's not a straightforward picture, but it all comes back to dialogue, having honest conversations within the groups to make sure that we're given as much as we can with the resource that we have available, and just try and be better for the right reasons.
Have you got the capacity, Mick, with all you've got going on, to be able to give the right level of holistic care to somebody who might reach out to you? Let's say you're preparing for a big tournament. You've got, I don't know, how many would be working under
20.
You? 20 working in there. Somebody comes along and starts to, reveal an issue to you. It's ringing alarm bells for you, but the tournament's a week on Saturday, Sunday. You've got 19 of the fighters.
I'd always put the boxer first. The athlete comes first. I think what's different as well that I've tried to bring to, not saying I'm like Moses or anything, but I'm trying to do something a bit differently, is that previously, the club level, it's about the boxer and the coach. It's one-to-one, like you said earlier. Internationally, you go with a group, you've got 10 boxers, 20 boxers, it's about the team. So the coach is the team. We now coach with constraints-based stuff so that you've got someone that's better than somebody else, but they're all taking the same on board. And it's trying to break it down that they're individuals still. One of the biggest things, we was talking to Jenny earlier, we had a meeting earlier about it, and one of the biggest things I thought we've brought on is it's not just about England coach after England coach after England coach doing the same problems, doing the same things. It's about fitness. It's about sparring. It's about bonding as a team. It's about getting that team to bond. It's an individual sport. Yes, you're an individual when you go in that ring, but when I got out of a tournament and Jenny's in the same room as me and she's up or not on Facebook or not in, or eating, and I've got to watch my weight because it's a weight-based sport, it's about being considerate for somebody else. We're based on medals. We're based on, well, I do a thing called success and success and consequence, and being part of our training. It's nothing really, it's just playing games with the kids, getting to know each other and building that team bonding together. But I just lost where I was. It's about building them as a team. That's the big thing. Oh, back to success. We have to go out and get medals. That's life. If you know, that's how things are. We expect to go out and we win. You know, we're doing what we're doing.
Well, I'm asking you the question. You're preparing for this big tournament, and one kid suddenly has an issue that may prevent them from going off to the tournament. So you're all, and he's one of your medal hopes that weekend. Yeah. And so he perhaps needs you, so you've lost the fighter potentially, and he's going to take part of your capacity as a human being to interact. He's going to take you away from coaching.
It's all about the boxer. It's all anything.
So you would have the capacity.
Definitely,
the culture within boxing now is such that it would be possible to deal
with.
It's
about it's about the performance. It's about the performance. If the kid can't perform, it's about the boxer at any level. If the kid's in trouble in the ring, the kid's in trouble outside the ring, the kid's being bullied, it's not happy, it's about the individual, it's not about the team, it's about in general. And if it means me coming off to that to speak to that boxer, then I'll so be it, or a physio, or one of the other coaches that relates back to that boxer. It's always about the boxer.
Without naming names or going back over the course of the time you've been riding horses into your coaching, have you ever known of examples where in hindsight somebody was squeezed too hard because they were had decent potential to win and somebody should have stepped in and looked after them a little bit better from a personal point of view?
I would think that we had a culture, and it is historical, where it probably happened too often. And and everybody probably in the horse world would know somebody who's left the industry because too much happened too quickly and they didn't build up enough resilience to be able to bounce back. And actually, it was quite interesting on the, I'm doing a performance level UK 4 at Gloucester, and they were talking about athletes who are very, very talented at the beginning being pushed and pushed and pushed to get right up to world class too quickly. And then they reach world class, they've never had a setback. They have their first setback and they quit because they haven't had that sort of hold back the social growth, so that we've actually put in place now, you might give them a stimulant, you know, it's not a real situation, but you might hold them back just because you can. Before,
but that in itself,
they
would
might
need
not
managing.
Like that,
yeah.
They might not like that conversation where you say, actually, you're not going to go on a team at this next championships, we're going to put you as an individual because we think that we want to give somebody else a chance, or we just want to. Whatever the conversation is, actually the long term is we want to give somebody a sense of what it feels like to have a setback when it's not really a setback. It's just so that when they do get a real one, they've known how to recover from it, because it's very much about recovery. And we were talking with horses, it's really easy to understand what it's like because you fall off a lot when you're little. And we put the hats on, the protective gear on, we do everything we can to make sure they're not hurt. And luckily, the little tiny ones bounce more often than not. And they probably hurt themselves more on a trampoline than they do on the horse. But the first thing is you get back on, you get back up, you get on, you come on. So when they fail at their GCSEs, or they don't get the result they want at their A-levels, or they miss a module in their, you know, university, it's like, well, what? You bounce back, you get back on your horse.
That's a really interesting point.
Do you know, but
the
they've had
skills.
That in there since they were like, what are you doing?
It's the ability of you as a coach to unlock that
to know they're not hurt
to
as
support
well.
The, you know, how do you transfer the life skills to the athlete stage of your life and backwards? What have I learned as an athlete? How does that transition into my life? And like, even as a, you know, one of the angles from a coach developer would be understanding the how through the why. So how do you do? Because there's a lot of nice infographics and courses out there that you can take on all this information. And then how do you contextualize that to my environment? How to take what I did in a big fancy situation or a big fancy gym into a small hub in the back of nowhere, or up to a field in the middle of nowhere when it's just me and the athlete. And then, you know, be in a position to, I'm ready to receive that feedback. I'm in a psychologically safe environment to receive the why questions and to be open about, like, I don't know, or actually that's a good point.
I really like what you said about the safe environment, because that is what that winning culture, the question you asked Scott was about what, how do you make a
winning culture without it being a win at all cost culture?
To me, I really think it's that being able to have a safe environment where they can take a risk, and if it goes wrong, they can tell you something's going wrong.
I think that comes back to that.
Tell me what's happening. Point of relativity, right?
So, yeah, this mistake, what does it actually really mean? Not what has somebody told me what it means? How does it feel to me at that given time?
That allows
people to react. And one of the sessions we do, which to some would sound absolutely ridiculous, is teaching coaches and athletes and parents and people, stakeholders within sport, the difference between professional resilience and personal resilience. Because you put somebody in the ring, on a horse, on the track, and they can perform in front of tens and thousands of people because they then become functional and they've been trained to speak and repeat kicks in. And so they know how to follow
that order.
Yeah. Ask them to make a social decision that has an impact on themselves or their loved ones or their kids or somebody else, and they'll fall apart. And it goes back to that driver of motivation. Are we building a complete person to be sustainable outside of that sporting circle, or is it performance led? And I think historically, statistically, it's demonstrated that we haven't been building the person, it's been performance driven.
So your argument always is that build the person and the sport will take care of itself.
Absolutely. If you develop a person that can make good decisions with valid support for themselves as well as those around them, you get a natural element of honesty around their performance.
I agree with you.
To be motivated.
This question for all of you, doesn't this take A, enormous balls, and B, enormous resources?
No, it doesn't have to. And again, that's one of the reasons why we designed the program the way we have. It gives a scale and brevity towards a problem that is global.
Just explain how for us, please.
So we incorporate both physical face-to-face workshop delivery and online, because there are challenges, either cultural challenges, language challenges, learning challenges. Historically in this space, it's been exclusive to those at the top level, and quite naturally, if you're exposed at the elite level, at the top of the levels, you will be given opportunity, because that's part of being at where you are. I alluded to earlier, the fact is you may not be an Olympian, but you may have played or you may have trained for 20 years. You still deserve the same opportunity. So we've designed a way that can be implemented in organisations around the world, and as a live example, we're working with the West Indies Cricket Association. You know, financially poor, but their desire to change the opportunities not only for their athletes but for society is huge, which is why they're working with us. And sport, you know, can learn a lot from that. You know, I had a conversation with the Premier League manager a fortnight ago, and you know, to fund something like this means they don't sign a player for a day. You know, that's they're the fine margins we're talking about in creating a program that can change lives for the long term. And so it goes back to that change of mindset, that honesty around, okay, let's have a slight realignment, because that's a healthy situation to be in. Let's reevaluate what our motivations are, and can we actually influence other people as well as that short-termism that is currently crept into what we do.
Jenny, how do we influence all those sports to act in that way, to put the athlete care
and coach care
at the heart of what they do? What are we going to do to change mindsets? Because everybody's alluded to the need to win. Mick talked about it stringently when we first got underway on this podcast. What are we going to do?
That's the $1 million question. I think there's so many opportunities out there for people to learn and share. And I think it's leading by good example. It's a willingness to share. It's a willingness, I think, I mean, like what Scott's saying there about the blended learning approach of, you know, what suits you, what's right for you right now. And if you need to know how to take this from A to B, then we're here to support you. And that feeling of support and saying, right, we appreciate what you're doing. I think, you know, I had a chat with a couple of the coaches recently, and we've dissected that sense of belonging that we talked about, and we've taken it to another level and go, right, I belong to something, but am I valued within that? And keeping that sense of what your values are, how valuable you are to the environment that you're in, and that you're supported in going forward. So there's loads of positive examples, and I think the more exposure they get and the more support they have to drive on, like there's always going to be that competitive element which comes into the robust resilience that Mick mentioned earlier. So we don't want to have we don't want to lose sight of that competitive edge, but it's doing it in a safe way.
And your delivery, it's about your delivery.
It's about
it?
The delivery.
Yeah. I think when you said about that sense of belonging, also and that valuing, you could have that sense of being appreciated within your sport. So you talk about that being there and being in it for 20 years. You might not have got a medal, but you've put a lot into your sport if you've been in it for 20 years and you've done your subscriptions and you've done your entries and you've done all buying all your equipment and you've travelled all over the country. You've invested a hell of a time and effort. And if you say, right, as a national governing body, we're going to appreciate what you've achieved for our sport, this is what we can now offer you. And if it's a program or if it's a mentoring system, we can offer you something. It doesn't matter whether you how many medals you got or whether you didn't get any. We value what you've done and we appreciate, and this is what we can offer you.
Yeah.
And I think these coaching programs can do that.
Yeah, it's that clarity through the pathway as well. It's from participation to high performance, and there are different bodies funding different areas. And like we know, even at UK Coaching and similar to what EY are doing, it's about the person. So what the needs of the person are, from grassroots participation, going from, you know, couch into a sport, and how, you know, what their journey looks like at that inception level all the way to high performance. And if they come out of it, where's the loop to get back in? It's okay if you take time out. It's okay if you explore different sports at a young age, but you're supported in that journey.
Professionally, Mick, who's looking after you? Who's watching your back?
Jenny.
apart from
Jenny, I don't
know,
it's probably a good idea, but probably no one, if I'm being honest.
Okay, how are you taking care of yourself? How are you making sure you don't burn out? How are you making sure you don't get stressed, you don't get exacerbated mental health problems because you're too close to the coal face and you know, too intense about wanting to win that prize or too worried about that?
That's
one individual.
I couldn't say, to be honest with you. I probably no one. I haven't.
You just tick over.
Yeah.
Autopilot, right?
Yeah.
That's common?
All the time, so, yeah.
Just from, I'll be honest with you, I mean, I've just broke up with Mrs. about a year ago. I've been with her 30 years. So for me, it's going to be busy. I'm so pleased to have Jeremy Carlo for telling you what I mean.
We do. I mean, with the coaches, it is common. And it comes, the behaviours arise in different ways and the different interactions. And that's what the benefit of the programme would be. We'll have workshops where we get together and we look at, you know, oh, you're going through something similar. Brilliant. Let's have a breakout session. Let's chat over lunch. And all of a sudden, oh, they're going through something similar. So I might share with them. Or the one-to-ones where, you know, Mick would know he could pick the phone up. We'd have a Skype. We'd go for a walk in the park. And that might look like something different and leads into a coaching practice. So it's got different levels of intensity, if you like, for want of a better word. But it's the willingness to say, you know, I need help. I need help with this. And it's not help in the big bad world of it. It's just saying, actually, I don't know what we talk a lot about work-life balance, but I've tended to gear a little bit more to the love-loathe. What do you love doing? Fill that pie chart with all the love stuff and the stuff you don't like doing. Let's just minimize that, or let's do what you need to do on a minimum basis. So, you know, sometimes the work part is the love part. So if we look at, you know, let's not have that separate. I speak a lot to the coach about what their downtime is. We do timetables where they get to look at different cells and say, oh my goodness, I'm doing 80 hours. I'm doing 40 hours. And we do little exercises to see who's in that friendship circle, who's your social, who's your external influences and internal. And it tends to be a lot of inside the sport. They're my bouncers. They're my people I share with. And is that a little bit in the confirmation bias area? You know, do they have a chance to bounce it to somebody outside?
That's why one of the reasons we have our provision online as well is to allow for that collaborative sharing, because it strips away that vulnerability of putting your hand up in a room full of people where you may feel uncomfortable. And it encourages a wider dialogue than that you're normally exposed to. It's very easy to become institutionalized by people that say the same and sound the same, because it breeds comfort and it doesn't stretch your imagination around healthy challenge. But again, it goes back to what the purpose of the sport or the organization is. What are we trying to achieve here? And then we can reverse engineer from that point to make sure it appeases everybody along that journey. Because otherwise, as Mick said, if you're not putting the people first and they're not receiving what they need to receive from this, it becomes redundant.
Shouldn't every sport have a point of contact for a Mick to be able to turn to if they were feeling difficulties themselves or they were feeling stretched, because in society and particularly across high profile sports like football, we're talking about mental health, we're talking about it's good to talk, but we're also talking about one in four of us have got mental health problems, but only 50% of us are reaching out for help. Surely all sport everywhere needs that point of contact, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think, as Scott alluded to earlier on, we're in a really positive drive towards that level of awareness. And I think as much as the responsibility would lie initially on the NGB to have some sort of service, it's the what does mental health mean, and an awareness of, if you are going through a tough time, that I have to step forward and I have to share with somebody, and there has to be someone to signpost, or I have to be part of a bigger system where I feel safe in that environment. So it's coming from all angles. It's the understanding of what it means. It's the courses and the level of education that people have on it and the willingness to step forward. But also, yeah, you're totally right. Having somebody that goes through the channel and sees what people are going through, not necessarily on the inside, but just that they're visible here and here. They're going through a lot. And yeah.
I think that there's a campaign that could be said for, you've heard that it's good to talk. But then if I said to you, it's good to talk to a counsellor, if you said you were going for counselling, or you told your mum you were going for counselling, what would the reaction be?
You'd probably want to keep it quiet to yourself.
Yeah, so
you?
That's what I want to break down. I'm like, well, you wouldn't say I'm going to the doctors or going for an eye off, going to the opticians to get a pair of glasses. It's not like a major deal, is it? It's
we spent loads of time talking about physical.
Well, if we're talking about mental health,
rehab,
who do we go to? We go to a psych, we go to a counsellor. If you say that, is there something mentally wrong with you? No, there's something mentally right with me because I'm going.
I'm aware.
The mentally wrong bit was when I was lying in bed with a duvet over my head thinking that no one wanted to talk to me. Not that I'm looking at anybody.
Mick, if you weren't currently involved with Jenny in the course and had your sort of peers involved in that, would you be able to turn to your own sport for a bit of help if you had a difficulty on that?
I've got mates in the sport.
The sport itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, RNGB probably got people I could go and speak to, I suppose, the chairman or something like that sort of stuff. I don't know, but I don't know if I'm in that sort of a relationship to. I don't know.
But again, it's the point of starting somewhere, right? So even if there's not an infrastructure in there currently, one of the reasons why ourselves and UK Coaching and Dialogue at the moment is to look at what the landscape currently presents and, okay, where can we enhance it? It's not a criticism. We're not sitting here criticising things are or are not there. It's always a point of, okay, how can we elevate what we currently do? Because anything that starts has to start. And so let's have positive discussions around that. Let's see where the pockets of real necessity are. And then let's start to layer that approach over time so that everyone is comfortable with what we're trying to achieve, but in a way that is manageable and actually makes a difference. We're not just saying we're doing something. We're doing something that will create a difference.
This idea of the programmes, what I think is so exciting is because when you said, I might not want to share that, I'm going, if you've got your NGB, can put you in how to get online and look this up in private, you can access help yourself. That might be just an ideal situation that you can do something for yourself, and then you can build up and say, I've been doing this sort of program and it's making me feel better, and then coaches can sort of encourage people to go and make things available, because I think sometimes you don't know what's out there, and I think sometimes being on the coaching development courses have shared with me what is out there, where sometimes it's hard to know if you're busy working and training and coaching. And
well, this is the point, isn't it?
Yeah, you want quick access to know where to get it from.
Or you don't want to come outside what the traditions of the sport are. Both of you spoke about kind of traditions and pathways and what has been done and what is right. And
it'd be very interesting to get this same group of people back around the table in a year's time and see if a greater momentum has been established. Because the only thing I worry about is it's okay to say we should all talk. Well, this is a question for the whole country. Does the country have the capacity to be able to deal with that if everybody does suddenly decide to talk?
Yeah, and especially around mental health awareness in sport, it's a different type of dialogue to the stats that you've shared just a moment ago, Mark. In sport, it's close to 2 out of 3 will suffer mental health trauma during or after their sports career. So that means that there's different pressures, there's different dialogue, there's different ways of communication. So that also, what that therefore means is that we have to create something that is different, because again, your exposures are varied in sport, it's heightened, And, you know, and you're experiencing potentially stuff as a 16-year-old that you wouldn't expect a fully grown individual to experience, because it's that intense and it means that much. So we're actually looking in that space as well about creating something that's specific to sport, again, because it deserves to have something that is appropriate for what it is that we're trying to achieve. And that goes back to listening, making sure that everyone that will be influenced in that journey has had a point to pass and had an opinion on it. Because unless it's going to be fit for purpose, unless it's going to do what we need it to do, again, there's no real point in us doing so.
Thank you all very much. That's it for another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears. Thank you for listening. Much more to come from a huge range of athletes, sports people, and indeed sports in future episodes. So do please keep an ear out. For more information about the programme itself, please visit our website. That's ey.com/UK/personal-performance-programme. This podcast and future podcasts in the Blood, Sweat and Fears series are available on iTunes and via the EY website by visiting ey.com/UK/PAS/podcast. It only remains for me to wish continued success to Victoria Gallantry, Mick Driscoll and Jenny Cody. And of course, a big thanks to Scott and Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, building a better working world. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Goodbye.